Happy Thursday, folks. Mike, Disco, how are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing well.
All right. I like
Got
it.
Got some energy today.
Do you?
Don't know why, but I have some energy.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like the energy,
Probably
too.
I slept.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. I mean, hey, whatever you got to do, whatever's working, I like it.
Who would have thought sleep would work?
Yes.
Who would have thought?
That's a lie. You don't need sleep. Great show today. The author of The Millennial's Guide to Changing the World, Allison Scheer, will be here. Also, Dilman Abdulkader, the director of the Kurdistan Project for Endowment for the Middle East Truth, will be here. So very interesting conversations with them. But for now, it's National Hot Chocolate Day.
I was wondering what it was going to be today.
It's National Hot Chocolate Day.
And it's cold enough to have a hot chocolate.
There's some people that need it.
Yeah.
There's some people that need it out there. Not sure about this whole global warming thing, you know, because some people saw temps as low as negative 75 last night.
Oh.
Yep.
Negative 75.
Man. This morning when I woke up, Chicago was negative 21, so...
I think, you know, a lot of people, Mike, you could have done this too. You just had a failed one. But instead of getting a vasectomy, you get on a plane, fly your ass up to, you know, North Dakota or something like that, North Dakota. And it's just gonna freeze it out. You're done. Yeah.
I was stationed in mine at North Dakota, so I know exactly what they're going through.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
It's brutal. So as the historically low temperature swept through much of the country, literally train tracks, I saw this article in Chicago, were lit on fire to keep the trains operating.
Wow.
The picture I saw was actually a little disappointing. I was hoping for like an epic cinematic scene.
Like the way it looks in Back to the Future with the trails?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't see that. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. But fire, snow, all this talk of global warming, and then this epic storm, you'd think that hell had literally frozen over. And you know what? It did. Mm-hmm. Hell froze over in Hell, Michigan. The low temperature was negative 15 degrees. This guy, Derek Wallbanks, Wallbank out there tweeted it out. It's negative 7. It dropped further after that. But in Hell, Michigan right now with a wind chill of negative 28. You know what that means, people? Hell is literally frozen over. So it literally froze over.
Clever, Derek. Clever. Yeah,
very clever. I think he's
I just want to know who named that town.
Not somewhere you move.
Yeah.
You spent time in Michigan. Where is
it? I did, but not in Hell. Yeah. I never went to Hell. I'm pretty sure Hell and East Lansing and Michigan State are like the same.
Yeah.
So you go to Michigan State, you're not going to get an education, and you're going to go to Hell. That's just what happens. I didn't make it up. It's just reality.
This is how it is, people.
But no, I wanted to start with this other story here. So obviously we're very politically divided as a country. People are at extreme ends of both spectrums, with those in the middle having essentially no voice, which is frustrating and needs to change. It really does. We joke here on the show, and there's a short list of people that land on the wrong side of our commentary quite frequently because this is a show. AOC comes to mind, Obama, Hillary, Maxine Waters. You're staying on the list for sure, Annie Maxine. But let me just say this. I may make fun of AOC, for example, but I wish no ill upon her. And in fact, I'd have a coffee or a beer with a lot of these people, probably even enjoy the conversation. I say that with Obama a lot. Like, I'd love to sit and have a beer and talk sports with Obama.
Yep. Because that's what you can do if you're sane.
Yeah, exactly. That's what normal humans used to do. Because discussions, not shouting matches, are important. You know, their ideas and policies need to change, but there's no need for exchange of hate that continues to grow. So to be clear with this, before we continue on with my little
diatribe
here, Bradley Manning's he's on a different list.
Yes,
so he's one of those,
all aware of that.
Yeah, so he's one of those people that I would not have a beer with. You're just a confused, traitorous douche. So we'll move back on though to where I'm going here. Case in point, with all the divisiveness, when asked if AOC would shake President Trump's hand at the State of the Union next week, here was her response.
Pay that tribute to the president. Will we be seeing you at the front row extending your hand?
You know, probably not my hand, but I'll be there and I'll be present to see and listen to what's going on.
Okay.
What does that mean, probably not my hand? Like, she's just not going to shake it?
Well, or maybe you give an elbow.
Like,
That's a lot of maroon, by the way. A lot of maroon going on there. But to me, it's just ridiculous, as was Nancy Pelosi's face and her looks of disdain throughout the address last year. I know this is commonplace now. I didn't appreciate President Obama and his policies. I think, you know, they greatly weakened America on the international stage in a lot of ways. But the one time I was in the same room with him, I was honored to be there. I shook his hand, and I respect the office. So we can disagree and joke and still be respectful, but no one really does that anymore. Okay. It needs to stop. And what also needs to stop is this atrocious story that everyone's talking about of Jussie Smollett, the case in Chicago. The details are still murky. you know, there's a lot of banter on both sides. Something sounds a little too good to be true for me, you know, if you're the Democrats, if you ask me. But you have to listen to the guy. While the rest of the world now follows the guilty until proven innocent model, we still here believe in you're innocent until proven guilty. So some of these things sound outlandish, don't make sense, you know, that people would have all these tools at their disposal at the time, right. You know, bleach and a noose and all this stuff at 2:30 in the morning. But you got to let the police flesh out the story and see what's true and what isn't. It does look weird, but regardless of the outcome, this should never happen. Whether it was done for this reason or that reason, a dude shouldn't be beaten. He shouldn't have a noose put on. He shouldn't have bleach poured on him. And whether there was, you know, discussion of MAGA hats and conservatism and this, that, or the other or not, it shouldn't happen. Like, it just, there's no place for it. So, you know, again, I've gotten my questions of this, and we'll see what the details are as they come out. And if someone did it for political gain and fabricated this just to make conservatives and Trump supporters look bad, that's equally bad. But bottom line is it's a lose-lose. No matter what comes of this, we all just lost.
Right. It just reserve judgment, just like anything else. You know, just get the facts first. And obviously something happened to the guy. And, you know, I'm just going to reserve my opinions until we get more information, because that's what we do. And I'm not going down that rabbit hole of this was staged, was not staged. The guy got, you know, obviously it. But, you know, I'm just going to reserve judgment, because that's the proper thing to do right now.
It's the wise thing
to do. I mean, we were discussing yesterday that, like, it's not like they just so happened to have a noose and bleach and everything else on them. Like, this was obviously premeditated somewhere. But where, how did it start? Where did it come from? We don't know. Let's wait till the police come out with that.
Yep. So we'll see. But for now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take a trip across the headlines. We got a few good ones today. Stick around. So close to 90%, that's a big number, 90% of the American voters say they oppose plans to grant amnesty to illegal aliens in exchange for securing a fifth of the border wall funds. Despite being touted as a bipartisan effort, American voters by an overwhelming majority are revolting against plans to give amnesty to illegal aliens enrolled and eligible for President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, in exchange for about $5.7 billion in funds to construct a wall along the U.S. border. One plan, which White House advisor Jared Kushner and other Senate Republicans devised, would have given about 700,000 DACA-enrolled illegal aliens 3-year work permits to stay in the country in exchange for border wall funds. So the plan has already failed to pass out of Congress. It's interesting to see this. There's a lot of, you know, you saw the concession, was that 2 weekends ago, of President Trump saying, okay, we'll do this. We'll give you this in exchange. Just give me my $5.7 billion. Which, again, in terms of government dollars, is not a whole lot of money that we're talking about here. But a lot of people are saying on the right, and even some folks on the left now, well, hold on, we don't want to give them that much. Aside from the conversation that's happening actually in D.C. and in Congress, where they're just fighting each other and doing things out of spite, you know, that's just middle school crap there. But when you look at it on a more holistic level and take it out of the context of that fight, it's interesting to see this. Hey, well, no, we're not going to give tax dollars and give them all that much. Like, let's not be cruel and heartless. But I thought it was just an interesting stat to read.
I don't think this is going to go anywhere. I think it's going to shut down again. And I'm sure he'll use that, would they say, the nuclear option or whatever it is, national security thing. I don't think they'll go that far, because that's, unfortunately, will next, you know, administration, to down the line or whatever, can use that for whatever they want as well. Yeah. I think they want to avoid from that. But, you know, here is the plan. I think they even floated a plan before for 1.8 million DACA recipients for the border wall funds. So that's a lot from one side, and that's a lot from the other side. So at the same time, they're like, no, we don't want to do that. You know, so where are we going to go from here? That's the question. It's a stalemate. It's not going to, nothing is going to happen, because if you already wanted that and then he offered that to you and now you don't accept it, I mean, this is the part where it's failed completely. And, you know, I think we'll find out, what is it, February? What is it?
15th, I think.
15th, something like that. That I don't think there's going to reach agreement.
Yeah.
And I don't know. People are going to look to the president for answers.
I think it comes down to a softball game.
I like that.
Let's put it down. Softball game.
I'd watch
NASCAR
that.
Race. This is how, put Pelosi, Schumer, and Trump in a NASCAR.
Put them in the Oval.
Two laps around the Oval.
At Bristol.
At Bristol.
Yeah, like a short. Yeah.
Bump and run.
Bristol. Yep. Well, then more than two laps.
We got a car high.
Schumer couldn't figure out how to drive that thing.
Just keep turning left.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of some Democrats there, you mentioned too, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, our good friend, has infuriated colleagues by aligning with a progressive outside group that's threatening to primary entrenched Democrats. Now, some of those lawmakers are turning the tables on her and are discussing recruiting a primary challenger to run against the social media sensation. So at least one House Democrat has been privately urging members of the New York delegation to recruit a local politician from Bronx or Queens to challenge AOC moving forward. This is a quote. What I have recommended to the New York delegation is that you find her a primary opponent and make her a one-term congressperson, the Democratic lawmaker who requested to be anonymous said. So this is interesting. You know, you've got a lot of people following her and obviously love her. If you're in that category of kind of more progressive socialists, you know, I mean,
right?
She's got her following. Obviously, she pulled off the upset victory. Is now serving in Congress and is there. So that part's done. But the establishment Democrats are very threatened by her, and I think it's really interesting to see this. Obviously, she just started, so she's got some time. But they've also got time to say, okay, if you keep going down this track, and you're going to continue to threaten the values that we've had forever, some of those people that have served there for like 6,000 years, like right. It could get interesting. I mean, you're going to have to spend a lot of money to beat her.
I don't think you will beat her because she's just going to learn more about how the place works. And then, you know, she's already broken the mold of what to do when she's there, and she's outspoken. She's a huge Twitter following, like you said, for the more progressives. But trying to find someone to counter that, I don't think they have right now. But at the same time, I think all these, you know, universal health care, the same thing Kamala Harris was talking about, free college and free pre-K and all that stuff, that is so outlandish and pie in the sky that it may turn off more voters on the left side come election time because, you know, even now you have the Dem politicians coming out saying, you know, let's get to the issues. Yeah, we all believe these issues. These are so huge, though, that they're not going to be in place in 2 years or 4 years, you know. I mean, because it affects too many people.
Right.
But to have the session, but that's where she's going, and she's going to learn. She's going to get more educated on what she's going to be doing. And, you know, if they don't counter it, then we'll see what happens with the establishment. Maybe the establishment changes. I don't know. But, you know, I don't think she's going to lose to the
I think you're right. I think the momentum is so strong with her right now. I would take a just behemoth plan and tons of money and a lot of things going your way to really even stand a chance.
And she's a good dancer, though.
She's a good dancer.
So.
Well, look, she's a young, attractive, and talented person. Yep. A lot of her ideas don't make sense, but there's a lot there to work with. So
she's just going to get more educated while she's there, and I think that's something they're going to have to deal with down the line.
Well, we'll see. So some news we saw earlier in the week: a bunch of people, briefing, you know, national security threats and all that. So directly contradicting President Trump, U.S. intelligence agencies told Congress on Tuesday that North Korea is unlikely to dismantle its nuclear arsenal, that the Islamic State group remains a threat, and that the Iran nuclear deal is working. The chiefs made no mention of a crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border for which Trump has been considering declaring a national emergency. Their analysis stands obviously in sharp contrast to President's most singular focus on security gaps at the border. Top security officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, CIA Director Gina Haspel, and Director of National Intelligence, which is a job we don't need, Dan Coats, presented an update to the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday on their annual assessment of global threats. They warned that increasingly diverse range of security dangers around the globe. They talked about North Korea, nuclear weapons, obviously Chinese cyber espionage, Russian campaigns to undermine Western democracies, all of that. So. To me, people made a big deal. See, it's so funny. You rip on it, both sides do it. You rip on the IC or you rip on the president, and then you use whichever one you want to. The IC is you ripped on the IC before. You think that they invade your privacy, and you think that they do this, that, and the other. But now they're saying that they contradict the president. Oh, I love the IC. Yeah, I love the IC. Stick it to you, President Trump.
Right.
My problem with all this is. Okay, I'm not. And this is not defending the president, but you have to take into account the level of politicization that has permeated the IC over the last decade, because it has. You know, the president is not, and his advisor are not the ones doing that. They're taking information that's being fed up. Right. The border is an issue. Is it the issue that this person or this person says it is? No, it's an issue that needs to be solved. If people will look at the stats and the violence that occurs from the people that come across, all of that, it's just plain facts. If you can't see that, you're not very smart, and you should go watch a different show. But
true.
But ISIS, absolutely, they're still a threat. You know, people are going to say we've defeated them, we've crushed them, we've knocked them down, we've mm-hmm. knocked them down. They're still a threat. I think we always say that on the show. We need to be talking about ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all these other groups, all the splinter groups that have come off them, Al-Shabaab. Yeah, I mean, so that is absolutely true. Some of those are political talking points. But I think people are making a bigger deal of this than it is.
Well, like, there's also the assessment that was public, and there's assessment that's going to be private.
Right.
So the private one, I mean, it all entails of what's going on in this world. But, you know, Trump's his whole thing was the border, immigration and border wall. But are we not talking about North Korea? Are we talking about Russia? I mean, look where all the is going. This was just an update on what's going on in the world for the present. But behind closed doors, I mean, I wish everybody could see that, I'm sure.
Right.
But, you know, save your judgment. But when they say, you're not listening to the intel community anymore. See, he's gone rogue.
Yeah.
He hasn't gone rogue.
No.
I mean.
Well, and every president's going to use talking points that benefit their agenda. These are all politicians, people. He might be a different kind of politician. He's a businessman and a savvy one at that.
Right.
But they all, you have to talk to your base, and you've got to go out and accomplish what you said that you were going to accomplish, or your toast. So that's not to defend or protect. I don't like that. I don't like that people play that game. But as you said, there's so much more reality to all this than what's going to come up in those briefings. It's just like every briefing in D.C. is a waste of time, whether it's the Comey stuff, the Hillary stuff, this stuff. You can't talk about the real stuff. And if people knew the real stuff, they'd be scared to death.
Anything public, all these, and we've seen it with all the others, is grandstanding by everyone just to get their time. And
yeah. I reclaim my time.
Right. Yeah. Point of parliamentary procedure, young man. I mean, it's that. It's just, you know, getting your FaceTime. But to really see what's going on, that's where the backdoor meetings can happen. But you are correct, them jumping on their side because Trump said, no, I think the border wall's an issue.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it went. You're exactly right.
Well, I rarely am. But
I agree with that.
But we've got to take a break. We'll keep at the headlines. We've got some strange ones on the other side of the break. Stick around. So this is disappointing, not surprising. We've got a web addiction problem. We kind of all know that in this day and age. Yeah, right?
No.
So shocking, though. Scale of children's internet obsession revealed by a new study. 7 out of 10 take their phone to bed, to include children under 5, who just, you know, spend infinitely way too much time online. A fifth of all children in the 8 to 12 category are on social media, despite the supposed ban on children under 13. A growing number of parents admit to having lost control. I guess part one is admitting it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lost control of children's habits. Youngsters aged 12 to 15 average nearly 3 hours a day on the web, plus 2 more hours watching TV, the study said. And it also said YouTube was a near permanent feature of many young lives, and that 7 in 10 of those aged 12 to 15 took smartphones to bed, which we kind of already addressed. But we've lost control in this, and children... Children are out there in the inner world web, you know, just doing what they will.
The key is being a parent and trying to figure out what they're watching. Now, they're going to be much smarter than I am when I go on these things and this and that. But you got to keep watching on them. But the other thing is, it's so easy if you're just having a day and you're like, mother of God. Here, take that. Just leave me alone.
Oh, totally
leave me alone.
Is. No.
You know, so I get it. But then you have to, you know, but all the now you got to understand that all the homework is on computers, all of these things on the phone. You're not sitting there with a pencil and a, you know, and a pad anymore. So I get it. But yes, going to bed with it or needing it to survive. No.
Yeah. I feel like you can't count the homework. I'm not saying you were, but you're right. Like I joke about it all the time. I'm so guilty. It's a total double standard. You know, go throw a baseball, you know, go do this, like, get outside and do stuff. Like, I lived in the woods growing up. I rode my bike, like, you know, I turned out okay. But, like, But yeah, we won't get into that. Yeah. My therapist says otherwise. But no, I mean, so I think that it's so easy to just say, you know, when you're tired, you're exhausted, there's no time, no one has any time. And just like Mike said, okay, hey, put on Frozen, man. I don't.
Yeah.
Put on to my girl, like, you know, put on whatever.
Or then you get this on Sunday. I get this alert, you know, every Sunday morning that says how much time you spent on your phone. The same thing, and you look at it and you go,
disappointing.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah. You know? Well, you went down a bad trend. You know when you've put that thing on the back, whatever those are called.
What are they called? The pop things?
Pop socket, I believe.
Excuse me. Now I'm official.
Yeah, so. You are.
Looks like you're holding a cigarette.
You and Tom Cunningham both rock those.
Tom Cunningham actually gave me the idea to put one on my phone.
Yeah.
So thanks, Tom.
I mean, one thing that my wife and I, we figured out about our kids is if we say, hey, you can't be on the tablet, but then we're on our phone. So we, when at home, it's phones are away, tablets are gone.
What Let's if I hang need out. You?
Well, I mean, it's I have
you need your phone on
when
you
it dings. I have a certain ring for Drew. I know that it's him, and so I go to it. And
Abby, that goes for you as well.
Yeah, you told me you put it on Do Not Disturb the other night.
I did on accident, and it was like I had phone calls from everybody, and I was like, oh my gosh, like what happened? Why did I do that?
I don't want to sound overbearing here, but I will murder you
the next time that happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, at least we have proof now that if I end up dying all of a sudden, we know where to go. Yeah. We know where to
Drew
go.
I'm not going to go as extreme as those guys in New York. That's just over the top. But
so there won't be any bleach.
No bleach.
Okay. Good. All right. Yeah.
So I should have thought of that though for waterboarding. That would have been great. Yeah. Southern water. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Waterboarded with
you'd
bleach.
You'd be die quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be die.
You'd be die quickly.
There would be no answers, I think.
No, it doesn't go very far. Yeah, no. So that's disturbing, what I just said, but also the story. I apologize for that visual. But just think about it for a second. Let's just be quiet.
That just went left quickly.
No, it really did. But no, so the internet and how we all spend too much time, adults included, that study was on kids, but you know we're all just as bad. So that's a disturbing trend. And then this is just flat out disturbing.
I got some mute music for you.
So do you?
Oh, nope, wrong one. There it is.
See?
Come on, disco. I mean, we can't. So,
there it is.
So we know there's a new segment of the population who are bad at talking to each other and other people in general, and just or they, maybe they just don't want to. And they apparently have disposable income to buy these new sex robots, right? So sex robots are a thing. We're not endorsing them, suggesting them. That one is not attractive, by the way. But apparently now, there are sex robot owners swapping used parts and selling bruised and battered dolls on a creepy online forum.
Ooh. All right, the music's going away.
Yeah, the music's got to go away. so, I mean...
Wow.
That, to me, is like beyond disturbing and gross. First of all, you don't exchange parts that you've done that with. Okay? Don't do... First of all...
I know where you're going with
don't
this.
Don't buy a sex robot. Okay? Right. There's people out there. God made us. He made man. He made woman. You'll figure it out.
Although they're getting quite realistic, I got to tell
you. They are.
And when I was trying to find pictures, you know, be careful about what you do when you search sex robots.
Yes.
You don't know what's going to come across
kids,
that computer.
Kids, don't search that.
Don't.
There's no kids watching. But
kids shouldn't be watching the show, Abigail just said.
That's a very fair point. But apparently this doll forum is like the go-to destination for owners of so-called sex dolls, acting as a safe haven for chat about the best models and sharing explicit photos and videos. Definitely don't want to see that. But it's also turned into this digital swap shop for buyers on a budget. So, you know, I mean, again,
I'm sure they sanitize the things.
There's no sanitization.
But you still have that. You're always thinking.
I would never use your sex robot.
I would advise against it.
Well, one thing that we were saying off camera, and Mike brought this up, you just got to remember what's underneath that sex doll, and that's...
This is the scary part.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so
we just don't know. I mean, those are the things. And can you imagine having that sex robot, and that's under it, and then you're like, oh, God, they're going to kill me.
Yeah. Well, unless it's like, you know, T2. I mean, Arnold was great. He was a good guy. I said it before. I cried at the end when he put his thumb up out of the... out of the
molten lava.
Molten lava.
Yep.
So he would have been kind. A gentle lover.
It's interesting where they're going. For those that don't,
I like how you're advocating for
want a relationship. They don't want to do this. You know, some of those robots are upwards of $100,000.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. Well, some of them really are, as you said, very realistic. I can see how a warped mind could go down that path, but you've got to have a lot of money and be broken inside, and probably live in
your parents'
garage.
But there's an industry.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating for it, but, you know, there's an industry.
No, there definitely is. There definitely is. We don't advocate it, but just the fact that there's people swapping them, and not just swapping them that they've had sex with, but also, like, there's that bruised and battered one. Like,
yeah, that's
like,
you're going into an area that's deranged syndrome kind of
thing.
Yeah,
you need a padded room, not a sex doll. You can do whatever you want in that room. Never mind. Anyways, we got to take a break because this is just getting weird. On the other side, we'll be with Allison Scheer, who is the author of The Millennial's Guide to Changing the World. Stick around. All right, welcome back, folks. So Allison Scheer is the author of The Millennial's Guide to Changing the World and also the founder of Millennial Inc., a consulting service that creates people and planet-friendly company cultures that attract, engage, and retain top millennial talent. She joins us now to educate us a little bit on the millennial generation. Allison, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Well, we give millennials a little bit of a hard time on the show sometimes. Let's go with a little. It's a lot. It's a lot. But you know, we know a lot of it's joking. Is this generation really what other people? I've not ever said this, by the way. But are they a lost cause, or are they getting unfairly stereotyped?
I think we are highly unfairly stereotyped, and I understand why. Because from the perspective of other generations, we don't make very much sense. But from our perspective, they don't really make that much sense. And there are infractions on both sides that have created our current social situation. And demonizing one another isn't going to necessarily pull us out of it.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think you're right. There is, you know, other generations don't want change. The younger generations coming up don't understand why. You know, there's just a big disconnect. What's not healthy, which is kind of the trend with everything we've got going on these days, whether it's that the generational gap or politics or what have you. So in your opinion, what sets the millennial generation apart? Like, what are some keywords or, you know, adjectives that you would put with your generation?
We are the most diverse generation in American history. We are also the largest generation in American history. We're the most highly educated formally of any generation in history. We grew up with globalization, with technology. So we have just a completely different mindset than other generations. And we're currently in this coming of age period in our lives where our brains are being shaped by social innovations that are becoming part of mainstream society and also political events. The millennials, at least the millennials who are about my age, all graduated into the Great Recession. So there's a lot of distrust around institutions, and are they working for us or against us? Can we trust them? Should we buy into them? Do our voices matter? And what I notice is that millennials have really strong communitarian values. We're very progressive. We're very creative. We're very emotionally aware. Some people think of this as us being emotionally immature, but in my eyes, we're just a little more emotionally aware of ourselves than other generations. And it's just that we lack follow through. We're kind of maladjusted to the world that currently is, and we don't take all of our strengths and utilize them to turn it into the world we want to live in that will help generations down the line.
Yeah, well, and I think that's probably one of the areas where you guys get a lot of flack is, look, having your ideas, you know, being progressive on this issue or that, you know, depending on what that is, you know, you'll cross a line for some there. But having your own idea and being your own generation, I think, isn't the problem. I think what happens is people get so rooted in it and are so supportive of it or against it. But then you've got this hit against the generation that there's a lack of work ethic. And people get dinged for that a lot, which when you combine that with everything else, it starts to give a bad name. Do you think that that's fair? Is it just kind of intergenerational misunderstanding?
We don't want to work 70 hours a week. I'm sorry. We don't want to give our entire lives to some company that's going to throw us under the bus and is destroying the planet. We don't want to do it. We would rather be self-employed. There's tons of also mechanisms for making money that weren't in place with other generations around the internet, Etsy, Uber, all these different ways to make money that if a company is going to abuse us in any way or expect us to sacrifice every single aspect of our health and our personal lives for their bottom line, while other generations convince themselves that that is noble, and we're able to overlook certain policies and practices that were being implemented that maybe weren't good for the people and the planet, millennials are more hyper aware of, and we want to be part of this change and this solution so that, you know, it's potentially forecasted that major systemic destruction could happen inside of our lifetime because of everything that's going on with climate change. And so we're the ones who are inheriting this planet. So we have to do something about it. And are other generations either going to support us or not? And are we going to be able to find it within ourselves to be empowered enough to work inside of the system and make those changes? So this is what I do at Millennial Inc. There's so many cultural clashes between generations. And it's exactly like you said, it's the same as men and women and blacks and whites and immigrants and Americans, all this identity politic clashing that's going on happens pretty violently between generations as well. And also, we have to come together now, and we have to be able to do almost a diplomacy work to be able to work with one another for generations to come.
Yeah. Well, I think so. You make some interesting points. I mean, look, what has to happen is there has to be an understanding that everyone is different and that there are changes. So it can't be my way or the highway for the millennial generation that, you know, hey, the world's changing and we're the ones coming up, because there's a generation behind that we don't know what they're going to be. I mean, we're getting a glimpse now. And the other generations that are still around, there's mine and above. So there needs to be that. But do you think that there's a willingness within the millennial generation to work with the older generations, the younger ones coming up, without the my way or the highway understanding? Yes, you know, corporate culture might not work for them. You know, I want to go and do this and have more of an independent job and drive Uber and whatever, fill in the blank. But just using some of the examples you use, is there some coming to the table in understanding on that, though? Whether it's, again, work, climate change, whatever. Hey, we disagree on this issue. We disagree on this issue, but can you come together on the others?
I think so, as long as we're not negatively stereotyping each other and we realize it's not about stereotypes, it's about archetypes. And millennials need mentorship just as much as, you know, like if older generations come to us and we're like, hey, I want to teach you what I know so that you can be more successful and you can understand why we did it the way that we did it. You know, everyone, people in companies who've been working there for 30 years, like, we've been duking it out for 30 years to figure out what's going to work inside of this marketplace. And now you want to come in and change everything. You could destroy my company. So it's really about making very small shifts that allow for innovation inside of companies and allow every generation's gifts to be considered equal and honored when they're brought to the table for the benefit of the company.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair point. Fair point. And I do agree. I think there has been a lack of mentorship to the younger generations, not just your generation, but the ones coming up. And that's going to be critical to bridging that gap and having at least a better understanding of where everyone's coming from. But listen, we've got to run. Where can people learn more about what you're doing?
You can buy my book on Amazon. I also have an audio book. It's called Millennial's Guide to Changing the World. And then if you would like to learn more about this work that I'm doing with intergenerational reconciliation inside of corporate and or other organizational cultures, visit www.millennials-incorporated.com.
Awesome. Well, Allison, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for explaining and giving us an insight into your thoughts and your generation's thoughts on where everything is. We definitely will look forward to having you back and keep an eye on everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
All right. Coming up, we have the director of the Kurdistan Project at the Endowment for the Middle East Truth, Dilmun Abdul-Kader. All that on the other side of the break. Stick around. Welcome back, guys. So I'm excited about this segment because we're talking about a region of the world that I'm very familiar with and love and respect greatly. Our guest, Dilmun Abdul-Kader, is the director of the Kurdistan Project at the Endowment for Middle East Truth, a D.C.-based think tank. Abdul-Kader is also a Middle East analyst, educates lawmakers on Capitol Hill on the Kurdish plight, and he joins us now. Dilmun, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Drew. It's great.
Well, so it's great having you here because, as I said, I've spent a lot of time in Kurdistan doing God's work, and I love the people there. I love the culture. I really do, and I'm not saying that. I love the region. So, but we know a lot about Kurdistan. Obviously, you do, but we do as well. There's a lot of folks in the audience. If you're being honest with yourself, you've said, yeah, Kurdistan. You've talked about it, but you don't know where it is. Give the audience just a brief, for those who don't know, where is Kurdistan? Who are the Kurds, just in general?
Definitely. Thank you, first of all. So the Kurds are a distinct people. They are majority Muslim, Sunni Muslim. They're landlocked between Iraqi Kurdistan, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. The population is 35 to 45 million. They do have their own distinct language, culture, history, dress. And currently they don't have a state, and that's what they've been fighting for ever since the fall of the Ottoman Empire and with the Sykes-Picot Treaty or the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
Yeah.
So the Kurds today are looking for support from the West and particularly from America to establish a independent state of their own.
And in your eyes, again, I've got my opinions on it, and I'm sure they're probably not too far off from yours, but how would a Kurdish state promote stability throughout the Middle East?
The Kurds are, first of all, they're very secular in nature, and they're pro-West and they're pro-American. If we look back in history and their involvement with the Americans, not one American life has been lost in Iraqi Kurdistan, for example, since from the 2003 Iraq War. And today we have the Kurds in Syria, with the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have aligned with the Americans as well, and they're very pro-American. You would see that American officials, American military officials in particular as well, have said that the Kurds have welcomed us with open arms, largely because we're not very liked in the region because of our secular nature.
Hmm. Well, and so what's your opinion? Like, I've got my opinion on Baghdad and also on our folks here in D.C. as to why this Kurdish state hasn't happened. But why do you think it hasn't happened?
In my opinion, I think we are, especially American foreign policy, does not have the appetite for creating a state currently, especially in the Middle East because of the volatile region. Also, it's very difficult to break down Iraq as a whole. We have the policy of we have a status quo policy, unfortunately, and we witnessed this during the Iraqi Kurdistan referendum in 2017, which overwhelmingly actually passed with 93%. Instead, the government, the administration, unfortunately, supported Baghdad, and what happened afterwards was basically the loss of over 50% territory of Iraqi Kurdistan. So the America and the West is at risk of losing the Kurds. That's the scary aspect of this, actually, largely because Kurds are looking towards Americans and saying, can we rely on you for the long term?
Yeah. Well, and as they should be. I mean, giving weapons and training here and there is great. But in the end, you need further support than that because you've got folks to the south. You've got folks all around you, frankly, that are going against what you guys would like. And all along, anyone who's served in Iraq, you know, writ large, and to include Kurdistan, knows that working with folks out of Baghdad and other parts of there, whether it's the army or the intel service or politicians, whatever the case might be, you'd always rather work with the Kurds. You're going to get more right. done. They're way more compatible to work with, as you've said. They mesh with us better. They're harder workers. And there's a lot of Iraqis yeah. right now cursing my name. But it's just true. It's just true. We've seen it. We've spent a lot of time there over the last decade plus. And this is what the results say. And I've always advocated, I don't know what your thoughts are, but not only do I think it should be a state, but at minimum, if as those conversations are going on, the U.S. should pour more money and invest more into Kurdistan and make that, you know, a stronger partnership, have a hub or a base there of sorts, whether it's in Erbil or wherever it might be, and say, hey, we're behind you. We're going to help you. And we collectively are going to help bring stability here to the region by having, units and strike forces that can go and keep the pressure on so we don't have another huge vacuum that gets filled by enemies there. I don't know. Is that a bad thought?
That's a great thought. The Kurds have multiple times have said to the Americans, make us your 51st state. That's just an example of how bad the Kurds want American support. And I think it's important that to realize that it does always fall back on the Kurds. We went into Iraq. We try to create a Sunni coalition. We try to work with the Shiite. But at the end of the day, that we went back to the Iraqi Kurds for assistance. Same thing is happening currently today in Syria. We try to provide armed support and funding to the Free Syrian Army, for example, the Syrian opposition. But it ended up falling back on the Kurds at the end because they were the ones who are in alliance with the indigenous Arab population. They were the ones who are fighting the Islamic State. So the Kurds are, we have to adjust our policy and see the region for what it is. And the Kurds are ready for American support, and they've been more than ready for a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I've said it multiple times. I'm rooting for it. It should happen, in my opinion. And a lot of the people who are making decisions about it back here haven't been there, don't understand, the synergy that's there between that relationship and all the good that can be done. But we've got to run for now. Thanks so much, Dillman, for being here and being an advocate for Kurdistan and the wonderful people that live there. We really appreciate all that you do.
Thank you, Drew. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
For the rest of you, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us. We'll have Trinity Merrill in studio with us tomorrow for a super fun show, so definitely check that out. Also, in overtime, we talked about deep fake the other day, so check out the overtime session on social media tonight. We're going to get back into deep fake and talk about a pretty interesting and entertaining, also terrifying, all those things, video. We'll show you what it is then. And finally, remember, when it comes to your news and political commentary, experience matters. We'll see you tomorrow.